Welcome to Creative Direction. This podcast was created to celebrate the courage it takes to become an entrepreneur. And we discover how working artists and creatives are making their way. As entrepreneurs, many of us had the desire, but not the roadmap. Creative Direction is meant to explore the diverse voices and approaches to working and making a living. It is our hope that this podcast helps provide some insights that might aid you on your own creative journey. I'm excited to welcome my co-host for this episode, Elijah Teague. He is also our producer and editor. Welcome to Creative Direction. Well, welcome to this episode of Creative Direction. We're here with Jonathan Neshi. Jonathan, just to give us a brief overview before we dive in, I'm curious, how do you describe yourself? You know, what do you actually do, man? I mean,
hey, Ross. Thanks for having me on. It's kind of a complex question because I think maybe 10, 15 years ago, I would say I'm a furniture designer, but I think it's starting to fall in the realms of art, but I don't know if the description really matters. I produce things for people that I want to see in the world.
Cool, very cool. Awesome. So you are furniture designer, artist. How did you get into that? You know, like, did you go to school for that? Were you, you know, self-taught? Like, what's the story there?
So I was married young. I was, me and my wife, Christine, were married 19 years ago when I was 20. And I was, at the time, I was driving a forklift for FedEx Freight in the docks of Chicago. It was like a well-paying job where I was able to get married and even have a kid that, you know, 22. everything kind of started kind of early for me.
Yeah. Life things started early for you, right?
But it was from 18 to 23. So I got married and had a kid in that time frame. So there's this guy at FedEx that would ask me, like, he knew that I was interested in furniture. So I was interested in furniture. I was like buying and selling it on the side. I would go to antique malls and he just could tell there was some like passion there. And he just like, did you know that people design furniture for a living? And it kind of blew my mind that that was a profession. So it's really just this question from a FedEx worker that, do you know that people design furniture for a living? That kind of spawned kind of a discovery to see what was next. So I think every entry level furniture nerd, you kind of get intrigued by the work of Charles and Ray Eames and Harry and Aero Sarandon, and I think those are the gateway drugs to design.
Yeah, I remember my first intro like to that was I was working at U of I, and we had an art gallery there, and there were some Sarandon chairs in this like art gallery, and it was kind of empty. And someone mentioned that to me, and I was like, well, who is that? You know, it's just kind of that happenstance thing. I'd gone to school there for 4 years and had worked there for two, so 6 years took. And then it only took someone just to be like, hey, those are a thing. Yeah. You know?
So then that introduction becomes this like peek into a whole world that that I became obsessed about and wanted to know more about. And the same guy that asked me, do you know furniture designing is a thing? Him and his girlfriend at the time commissioned me to design a side table for their
apartment. That's awesome.
So that was kind of and it was like a ode to a George Nelson bench, the slatted bench. So it was like a variation of that. So it wasn't an original idea, but I kind of learned some really latent ideas of, you know, ideas that how they translate to the physical world.
That's a pretty supportive person to introduce you to design and then like,
yeah,
there you go, make me something.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
That whole story that I said in two sentences is really a 2-year period at FedEx where I went to night school at in the suburbs of Chicago to learn computer-aided drafting, so CAD drawing, AutoCAD drawing in 3D. Cool. So it was a certification in drafting through from Moraine Valley Community College in Palos Hills or Palos Heights.
Yeah, I took classes there. I took like music camp there, I think. I was there.
Great. So. Classes, so the professors were, you know, they did the occupation in the daytime and taught at night. So it was there was an efficiency for sure in the translation of, I guess, learning the tool to get the ideas out of my mind. So there was no design classes there. It wasn't, it was really about learning the tool. And there was people in my class like doing crazy animation and really amazing computer drafting work. And I was a C minus community college student who could barely keep up. Learning school became the best. It was 2 years in night school. My wife was pregnant at the time, and FedEx had a tuition reimbursement program.
Oh, nice.
If you got a C or better, they paid for the classes. So I took advantage of those opportunities, and just kind of thinking about those, like that opportunity was like the first rung of the ladder out of kind of working class. So I, you know, I have a lot of gratitude towards a corporation for, you know, not only having a full-time job with benefits where I could support my family, but also this opportunity to better myself. So, but during that time, driving a forklift, the FedEx furniture would be on the dock sometimes by Herman Miller and Noel and Fritz. And I would just totally nerd out.
Yeah.
There's two egg chairs going down the dock, and the people around me knew the obsession was real.
Yeah. That's great. That's excellent. So how did you kind of build your way out of that? How did you quit FedEx at some point, or like what was the transition?
After 2 years of night school, I got a certificate in 3D drafting from Moraine Valley. And that was coming off my fifth winter at FedEx, freezing my ass off.
Chicago, that happens, right?
Seriously.
Dock, so you have a roof but no walls. Mm-hmm. And you, in the winter, you'd be driving basically a go-kart with forks. And it was, you'd come home and have to thaw out in the bathtub. And it was after the fifth winter and, you know, kind of coming to getting the certification, I could tell that graduation day was coming.
Yeah.
And at that, during those times I was buying and selling vintage as a hobby. So I'd go to estate sales and thrift stores and I'd find vintage furniture and I'd put it up on Craigslist and eBay and sell it for a profit.
Cool. That's a lot of hustle right there.
Yeah,
that's
definitely.
It was great. Able to fuel my research, but also, seeing a direct correlation to knowledge and business, that the more I knew in this business, the more I was able to continue doing it with more resources. So, for one of the pivotal stories in there was me and my wife went to an estate sale and there was a coffee table produced by the American manufacturer Lane. Mm-hmm. It was a boomerang shaped walnut coffee table for $9. And I didn't want to buy it because it wouldn't fit in my Honda Civic. And my wife said, we have to buy it. And I put in the trunk of the Civic and took it home, took a photo of it, posted it on eBay, and it sold for $1,200, something like that. So it
was wow.
Just a tiny profit is a
small margins.
This insane profit at, 20 years old, 21 years old.
Right? Yeah.
So, then I start putting together this, it's passion and it's business. So I can do this and make a living, but also, explore.
Yeah. Was that all happenstance, or did you have, I mean, did you just kind of figure out that you could buy and sell that stuff by?
Yeah, it was all happenstance. And, you know, you know, eBay, this is 2002 to 2004. You know, I got my certificate in 2004. So during that time, this is, you know, kind of eBay heyday.
Right.
Buying and selling. And on eBay, Richard Wright, the kind of famous modernist auction house in Chicago, where we met Russ.
Yeah.
They were blowing out some kind of extra furniture on eBay, just stuff that was laying around that was nothing, you know? Right. So, some blown out Eames chairs were on eBay and a bunch of stuff. And I actually found Wright Auction through my searches on eBay.
Oh, no kidding. That's wild.
It made this connection that this mecca for modern design was in my backyard. And I became pressed that this is the place that I need to move next. I cold emailed Richard Wright. I think I sold myself in the subject of the email, you know, because at the time I was kind of buying and selling and doing some light refinishing and restoration work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all things they need people with expertise there to help with, you know.
And he hired me. Well, he actually said, "Oh, great, we need help. When can you come in?" And I right away, and I didn't hear from him for 2 weeks. So I was just like, you know, I have this email out, this reply that we have help, and then dead quiet. So I was like, oh man, what's next? After not hearing from the email, I just picked up the phone and called, and it happened that he was in Europe and, you know, kind of doing what he does, pulling in modernism.
Can you repeat what he was doing in Europe again? We lost you on that. Break it up a little bit.
Richard would go to Europe to make deals for consignment for the auction house for important modernist works. So he was gone in Europe during that time where he said to come in. And when I called, he just happened. He's like, you called me on a good day because I'm traveling out of town tomorrow. Can you come in for the interview today?
So, oh, wow.
I'm living in LaGrange, Illinois at the time with, you know, a wife and a 1-year-old, you know. And I'm like, I'm going to Chicago. So I hopped on a train and had an interview with him. He hired me on the spot.
Oh, that's awesome. That's so cool.
I was making pretty good money at FedEx. Mm-hmm. And I think he offered me maybe 30% less than I was making at FedEx. And I was like, as much as I want to work here, like my priorities are to take care of my family.
Right.
And he matched my salary from FedEx, which is,
oh wow,
that's awesome.
He gave me shit about it for years. That, that I was negotiating as a, you know, a 20, you know, 2-year-old with no college experience. And I give him just, you know, I'm eternally grateful for that kind of leap that he took in hiring me, because the next 5 years working for him was my education. That was my PhD in design history. That was my PhD in conservation. And, you know, it was like, it was really my, it was my school while I was, you know, getting paid to work for him and, you know, learning from the best designers of the world in the world.
Were you making any pieces for yourself at this time, or were you still just kind of absorbing at the time?
The early years were really absorbing and just really understanding, design, where things were coming from, what they were made out of. I was there for about a month and a half when I was helping install a chandelier in the showroom and dropped a screwdriver on a 1929 Paul Frankel coffee table.
Oh, oh no.
Milwaukee Art Museum was coming to look at it. So I'm very lucky he didn't fire me on the spot for that. But that was the first, that became the opportunity to find a solution. I found this, this guy in Chicago who could drill holes in glass and reproduce this piece of glass. 1 month after that, a 1930s Gio Ponti desk was coming in, made out of blue mirror. Mm-hmm. It was a vanity, not a desk. And I got an email from Richard, this important piece is coming in, don't break it. And that was the email. It was perfect. The one last screw, I over-tightened it, and the whole top shattered.
Oh, my gosh.
My heart just sunk.
I have an incredible record at Wright. I only broke one thing when I was there the whole time. And we just missed each other. It was a Scandinavian vase. And it had a shape where it was like a little flower almost. And I had it all lined up the way we were shooting it. It was on the edge of a table. So you had that little horizon, right? I had everything lined up. And I just put my hand down just to like reach forward and like nudge another one. And this thing just toppled over the back of the thing. It was just like, oh my God.
So, yeah, Richard, what did they do?
This thing survived 70 years and it breaks here. Like,
yeah, it was rough. That stuff happened. So, did you?
I put the glass on a stretcher. You know, I put it on a piece of wood, and found the only place in Chicago that has blue mirror. And ooh. I found out that they open at 4 a.m. At 4 a.m, I show up outside of near O'Hare Airport with this dead broken glass on a stretcher. Mm-hmm. You know, can you heal me? Can you help me? I can produce this for $600. So this happened late in the day before. So I let Richard know the next morning. I've got good news and bad news. Broke this glass. The good news is it's going to cost $600 to fix and it'll be ready week. And he's like, okay. And that started my career in restoration.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But that's great. I mean, that's like.
Formed my job there by breaking shit, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you made that contact and you obviously learned from it a little bit. Don't tighten those screws that hard, Jonathan, right?
I have like 100 stories like that where it would just, things would come in damage either through shipping or through someone dropping it and I was then exposed to machine shops and glass artists and woodworkers and upholsterers and you just learn how this stuff was made and then how it's recreated or repaired or restored. And that became a big part of my job there.
Did you find that it was a little bit more specific than just fixing something? I feel like I learned a lot, certainly, because we worked the same place, even though we kind of missed each other by like a year or something like that, where you actually really had to learn even in more depth how things are made and how to describe to someone else how to make it, because it's so specific, because it has to look like the original thing, right? Is that fair? Do you think that you learned a little bit more?
I think that became the art form that I still practice today, is being able to find competent talent and being able to decipher who's competent and who's the bullshit artist acting like they're competent. You learn what's real, who's real, and you know, I guess that sense is, I think you start being able to know who's an expert in their field. And so I never actually physically did the restoration. My job was a series of relationships then with experts, people who at top of their craft. So that those 5 years of doing that was my training ground for what I'm doing today.
Cool.
Yeah. So that ride ended in the very end of 2008 when the financial collapse of 2008, when, you know, the auctions were a third of what they were the year before or whatever the number right. is, you know. But I launched my first line of furniture 3 years after starting at Wright in 2004. So I launched my first line of furniture in 2006, 2007.
That's crazy. That's great.
Kind of soaking it in.
Yeah, it took me 7 years to leave and do my own thing.
we're the alum, you know, yeah. I'm the class of 08, 09. You're the class of whenever you left.
I don't remember. It was late 2017. Who knows? Yeah, 2018. Yeah.
Daughters.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a great place to you expose to world-class design and art, and to the others to practice. I mean, you practice your craft, I practice mine. I mean, it was good. And I always felt, you know, Richard was very fair. He's, you know, it's interesting to run a business that big, or see it being run, you know?
Yeah. I mean, kind of an amazing boss in that way is that he allowed you to make mistakes, number one. And number two, there was a liberty to own your work in a way.
Yeah.
Which I'm grateful for that opportunity. It really shaped all my steps after.
Yeah, it was a really great place to start. Tell me about some of your fabrication partners. You know, you talk about you have these connections you carried forward. You make like really, I don't want to say complicated because it's very modernist and minimal work, but it's complicated how it's manufactured because to have those type of tolerances, you really have to have people knowing how to make things work that aren't on the surface seem like they're simple. Like a sheet of metal seems like, yes, it's going to be these same dimensions. It's going to be, it's made to spec, whatever, but it's still a physical imperfect thing in an imperfect world, and you kind of make these perfect looking things. How do you even start doing that?
Yeah. I mean, I think a few of the vendors that I worked with when I managed restoration at Wright became some of the producers of my own work. So there was already a baked in relationship, which was nice. But what I learned early on was there was, I think I was only at Wright for, you know, 4 months or something like that before my wife was pregnant with my second child at 23, you know. So like you can't gamble so hard when you have that much responsibility. So I learned early on the efficiencies of production and understanding who I'm talking to and what they're capable of. And the prototype has to be like, I can't afford to do five prototypes. The prototype has to mm-hmm. be a finished piece. Right. By being hyper cautious in the beginning of the next steps, I kind of learned some efficiencies in production with, it's a combination of, and I also learned that labor, like material was expensive, but not as expensive as labor. So labor, right. labor was much more expensive. So using digital fabrication, water jet, laser cutting, sheet metal, you have a high quality material and, you know, $500,000 machine doing the cutting. But if it was designed in a specific way, the labor actually was pretty low, so that you let the machines do a lot of the work, and created a few production methods where it was lower labor, higher finish. But the so it was like it had to be perfect round one. So it was a combination. Right. I wasn't an engineer at the time, so a lot of the forms that I produced were kind of novice engineering. You know, it's what I could handle at the time. And then over time, as I was able to get help from outside engineering, I was able to kind of up the complexity of the pieces by having people who are dedicated to metal engineering. So it took some time. It took some time. And it was never like, it was always one step at a time. It was never jumping or taking high risks. It was taking one step in a direction that I think would work, but I wasn't sure. And then once you take that step, then you have the confidence to take the next step. It's very slow. And early on, it was the average was 5 years from the time I launched something to the time I sold the first piece.
Holy smokes.
So, you know, during that time, you just think that, like, what is wrong? Like, and there is no results. So for years, I averaged a 5-year window of launching something into the world and waiting.
So what's going on in between that time? What's going on during that waiting process that eventually makes it able to sell in those 5 years?
So you'd have little windows of success that would, or little windows of opportunity. Mm-hmm. So we would see that you're doing this and then invite you to an opportunity to do that. And that was kind of one step ahead. So during that whole 5 years of launching product, there's opportunity to launch more products. So the first 5 years was really mostly launching with a couple home runs.
Right. Yeah.
Very few first base, second base hits. It was like nothing or a complete grand slam.
Mm-hmm.
So there was enough good thing happening where, you know, that encouraged you to going, but.
Wait, say that again? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
There was enough good things. There was enough results that they were encouraging. You know, it was a small result or something that would kind of get you connected or a new opportunity.
Do you remember, like, what one of the projects was that was, like, a grand slam maybe early on or your first grand slam
thing? Yeah, so the first piece I launched was the H1 coffee table. It was two plates of a quarter inch steel plate that interlock. So there's just two water jet plates of steel. It was very simple with a glass top. I submitted that to a Design Within Reach competition in 2006 and didn't make it into the competition. But part of the competition rules is you had 3 months to produce it for the exhibit. And I kind of threw, I was like, well, if I did get it in, could I have produced it? So even though I didn't get in, I still went through the exercise of producing it. And I didn't sell one till 2007. I didn't sell the first one till 2012 when Louis Vuitton asked for it in mirror polished bronze.
Oh, that's super cool. Like, that's
awesome. So there, it shows that there was nothing wrong with your original idea. It just didn't
right.
take time.
Yeah. So yeah, it was worth the wait. It sounds like
that's a hell of an audience to reach with it as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a crazy thing that, I mean, that helped me launch full time. You know, so from 2007 to 2012, I was either working through right. or buying and selling vintage on the side and hustling. So that was my very first design to have that kind of success was 5 years later. It was great. We have a mutual friend, graphic designer, Rick Valicenti, who you know, I remember early on complaining to him like about this time frame, and he's like, you don't hear a Christmas tree farmer complaining that their tree's not tall enough to sell. Like, you plant the seed and you wait. Yeah.
That sounds like a very Rick thing to say.
That story, because it's just like he's a mentor to so many people, and that little piece, that little nugget of wisdom actually carried a lot of times. There was another, while I was at Wright, I had a home run early on where, so I launched my first line of furniture at ICFF, which is the International Contemporary Furniture Fair in New York City, where I took 2 weeks off of Wright to launch this line of furniture, and maxed up my credit cards, borrowed money, produced a whole line, like, you know, had a booth at this fair. If anyone would have actually taken an order at that fair, I'd be totally screwed. A famous designer from England, Tom Dixon, walked into the booth and was like, oh, nice pieces. How much are the stools? I was like, it was some weird arbitrary number, like $1,040. He's like, $1,000? Bloody hell. Like, and, but that kind of launched then, it just opened up more opportunities after that. So I started working with Ugo Alfano, design gallery in Chicago. He took Ugo Alfano from Chicago, where he took a lot of some of the pieces that I took to New York, and he helped me produce them in different materials. So we made the table in brass, mirror polished bronze, and then the shelf in mirror polished aluminum.
Cool.
And that was the second home run, where he took one of the shelves in mirror polished aluminum in addition of eight, and took it to Paris in like early 2008. And he called me and said, we sold two. And then he called me an hour later, said we sold two more. And then he called me a few hours later and said we sold the whole edition of eight.
Wow.
So the edition of eight sold in one day in Paris.
That's awesome.
And that all, you know, that was maybe 7 months after ICFF in 2007. So, and that was an early home run that kind of offset my early risks.
Yeah.
That I took. So, yeah. And it kind of has been one story after another since of similar things, of taking a risk and waiting.
Mm-hmm. So was it after your time at the auction gallery that you decided to move to Columbus, Indiana?
Let's see. So after that, that success in Paris in early 2008, I kind of shoveled myself out of early debt, and the gallery owner reinvested into new work that we were supposed to show in London in September 2008. So we spent months producing a whole line of shelves and stools and side tables and pedestals. Like, it literally just was producing so much work during that time. We launched it in September 2008 in London, and this height of the financial crash, where you just go back to the hotel room and watch the news, like glued to the news of the world. And then what we're experiencing now, but and it was in a different way. So it was like, and during that time, Richard Wright saw the success we had in Paris and was like, okay, I don't want to get in the way of your success. You're working here. What can I do to help you?
Right.
I was like, I need to work 3 days a week and not five, just to produce this work. And he was super gracious and allowed me to do that. So I was, you know, really producing work 2 days a week and working at Wright 3 days a week. So then we launched in London, zero sales, and, you know, coming off a home run to have then nothing at all. And you took a gamble working 3 days a week at the office.
Right. Yeah.
You're hoping that would pay off, right? You know, and then it doesn't.
Off, and, you know, that also meant that I took a 2 day a week, you know, salary cut. So, taking a gamble there didn't pay off. And then we had one last run of showing at Design Miami for the second year. And then nothing selling there either. So this is two shows in a row, no sales. And then 2 weeks after that, at the very end of 2008, being let go with half the staff at the auction house was just a crushing blow.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So it was a tough time to start a career, but
good time as any, right?
You know, and then I just spent so then that became a you know, not having a full-time job with benefits and not having sales at the gallery. My wife and I and our two boys were just looking for a simpler life, or a lower cost of living. And moving to Indiana became a family decision, where we moved almost to Louisville, about 30 minutes north of Louisville in southern Indiana. We moved there in 2009, the summer of 2009. And lived in this little town of 4,000 people.
Wow.
About 45 minutes south of Columbus. So, but we lived on the town square of this quaint little, very, very small town.
Mm-hmm. And
lived in a 3,000 square foot loft apartment on the town square with 12-foot ceilings and exposed brick. And
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, sounds really nice.
So, and we were there for 5 years in the small town. So we went from Chicago to a town of 5,000 people in southern Indiana to weather the storm of the financial collapse of 08 and 09. And it really, they were some of the most productive years I've ever had in my life because of the separation from the city. So there's less to do, so you do less, which yeah. This buffer to explore. So I would find local metal shops, and then at this whole time I was subsidizing, making a living by buying and selling vintage. So it's kind of like going back to, you know, what you know. And that was, it was a great 5 years. I started working with Sam Vins and Claire Warner from Volume Gallery, who also I worked with at Wright Auction House. And that was their first show. We took over Andrew Rafitz Gallery in Chicago for a few weeks with eight new designs. And, you know, it was a brand new idea. So there was no money and no money, no space, no marketing budget. And I went back to all these contacts that I developed over the years and pre-sold the eight pieces to different either dealers or collectors for cost of goods. So when you went to my show at Volume Gallery in 2010, every piece was sold only because it was sold for cost of goods.
But still did that. Did you find that generated more interest in you a little bit, having a sold out Sold out show? No. Sorry. I was hoping to work out for you, buddy.
I'm not that savvy, number one. Number two, it was like this, it was this way to make something out of nothing. Like, yeah. Fuck me. It was, there was no money. And it was kind of using a network of relationships to build something. So, you know, the clients were happy because they got something at cost. And, but what that did is that gave us images, that gave us photos of the product to sell.
Yeah.
And it became a playbook that I use to this day, that, you know, if you can find someone to fund the cost of goods of a new idea, you're not sitting on resources for, let's say, 5 years, you know?
Right.
And then if you build in enough money to pay for photography, you now have an image that you can sell the work on. So,
right.
And then the year later, I had my first solo show at Patrick Parrish Gallery in New York. At that time, it was called Mondo Cane. That was 2011. 2010, I launched a piece called The Secretary with a gallery in Soho called Matter. So it was just, it was a lot of, like, one opportunity brought another opportunity, brought another opportunity. Mm-hmm. And being okay with not getting paid for the work you're doing, knowing that you're investing in the long game, that, you know, I say to this day, the short game's for suckers. It's not, you know, being able to be patient, that payday is coming if you plant good seeds, I guess.
And I, you know, I don't know the financial side of things, but that strategy has paid off for you, at least in the more and more visible work over the years. You know, you recently had fabricated and installed the Neshi Dome at the Ace Hotel in the city of Chicago.
That one's really cool.
One of my favorite pieces of work, and it has your name on it.
Hey!
So that's cool. And I was able to, like, sit on it and have some drinks and hang out. Can you tell us about how that kind of worked out, or how that's happening, and a little bit more about that?
Sure. So what I've learned along the way is knowing who the client is. And one thing I learned, that the end user is, for, in my business, is rarely the client. So for the most part, my work sells to an interior designer or architect. And they are placing that work in an interior or a space for their client. So I'm actually removed from the end user. I would say probably 5% of my work now is sold to the end user. Most of it is going to interior designers.
So you're business to business, mostly, is what you're saying.
So I'm business to business. And then as you know, in any business, there's an internal language, and being able to speak that with the interior designers who fully understand, and then can be the buffer in translation, is has been super helpful. So what happened with the Neshi Dome is, there was an interior design firm out of LA called Commune Design that did the interiors for many of the Ace Hotels. And when Ace Hotel was looking at the space in Chicago, Commune was in dialogue with Volume Gallery to do some of the artworks in the interior. So okay. The interior, there's a lot of artists who did specific pieces there, and kind of the pinnacle of that was a rooftop installation that became a design competition in a way. So I think early on they paid 6 designers, and then I did a lot of different variations and submissions, and then it came down to me. And using my same playbook, I spent the whole entire budget on the piece without a profit. So at the end of it, I was like, I'm calling this the Neshi Dome purely.
Yeah, you got it.
It's not that big, number one, but this is a business decision. It's the Neshi Dome. And it kind of, it was so silly. The name was so silly that it kind of fit.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of a silly piece of architecture. It's like an adult
it's
jungle gym, you know?
A community hammock, you know?
Yeah, right.
And it was this merger of these two early Chicago ideas. The jungle gym was a product of Chicago. One of the first ones being in Eliel Saarinen's elementary school in Winnetka.
Mm-hmm. It's wild.
So this is in the 20s or 30s. And then there's the Tiffany Dome in the Cultural Center in Chicago on off Randolph. And so it's kind of this merger of the jungle gym and this glass dome. You know, and then in this kind of Chicago blue. So, you know, I was trying to be sensitive, but it was also kind of raw information too, that you kind of, I don't think any of my work, I don't think I'm not inventing anything from the ground up. I'm using ingredients, and that mixture of ingredients is specific to my experience. So I think those combinations created that. And it's been fun. It's been fun to see people interact with that. And that public sphere has been important in the last few years. I think with my other work, it's in an interior, it's in someone's private home, and it brings joy to, right. You know, the people that live there. And it's fun to kind of jump scales and jump audiences to a broader public audience. So.
Yeah, you've had a few other public works projects, I think, in Columbus.
Right? Yes, Columbus has been that. Yeah, Columbus has been that. So in 2014, I actually moved to Columbus, Indiana to pilot an idea we end up calling Exhibit Columbus, where contemporary designers and architects interact with the kind of famed architecture that's in the small town or small city. It's 45,000-50,000 in the city and 80,000 in the county. It's a metropolis compared to the small town too after in 2008. But the interaction with the community became became kind of the next chapter of my career.
That's cool. And so what have you done there? I mean, I know like recently you did a skate park or were involved in a skate park that was fabricated.
That's awesome.
And you can tell me like you did a few different things. I know you had some stools that were built. I'm not really sure outside of where. What have you built that's like more public that people could maybe even, I don't know, go and like actually experience and sit on?
Yeah, sure. So Columbus, Indiana is famed for its architecture. There is 80 significant works of architecture here, mostly headed by J.I. Miller, who is the CEO of Cummins Diesel Engines, which is their global head here. And in the 50s, in a way to attract talent to make the community kind of competitive with other communities, he invested in education, particularly the architecture in schools, as a way to make the environment attractive to for him to attract talent to this corporation. Mm. And that spawned and he did this in a way where he would pay the architecture fees for any public building that was, if you introductory and a matchmaker and some patronage. But what that did is that catalyzed all these
works of architecture in the town. And there were some criteria if it was kind of paid for by public funds, if it's a civic building in any way. So that ended up, you know, every police station and fire station and school and library and city hall, all these buildings then became produced by the most prominent architects of the day. So Ara Saarinen has multiple buildings here, and Kevin Roche, and Eliel Saarinen, and Ian Pei, and Robert Venturi. So it's a really special place, but it's, if you come here, it's a civic modernism. There's not, there's very few modernist homes here. So it was really a community kind of built, it was, you know, kind of high design built for everyday people. And this became an amazing place. This kind of, this town actually matches my personality so much, where it's just, it's every day, but at the highest level, you know, like, I like this, this environment for, it's like a proving ground or testing ground for ideas. To, you know, because the population's lower, you can actually try things out and see if they work. So I moved here in 14 to do this, to pilot this installation at First Christian Church by Eliel Saarinen. And we moved here, and my kids were young at the time. I think they were 9 and 11. That's right, 9 and 11. So they were kind of at the end of elementary school, headed into middle school. And this small town became a really nurturing place to raise a family. So yeah, the architecture is great, but if the schools were terrible, there's no way I would live here. you know, it became a, you know, the model worked because, you know, it, 70 years after the idea or 60 years after the idea, I'm moving here because of the environment and the opportunity for my children. So I think just like anyone else who is maybe taking a job at Cummins, you know, I'm going to move here and have a career, but also it's not just about me. So, so integrating into the community, there's just been a ways to play matchmaker myself and pair some designer friends and architecture friends to opportunities here. So, early on, like I mentioned earlier, our friend Rick Valicenti, we pulled him in to do my project, 100 Variations, and then he developed the identity and was very involved with Exhibit Columbus. And then just recently, I was able to make a connection to an architect in Finland who was a professional skateboarder. His name is Jan Asario. And he designed our skate park.
How did that go? Were you just like, hey, Jan Asario, what's up, dude? Let's design this thing.
Very much so.
That's awesome. That's so cool.
I actually heard him on a podcast, 99% Invisible, where they tied the history of skateboarding back to California.
Yeah.
The pools. And then they tied that back to Oliver Finland, who did these biomorphic pools in the 20s, and then tied it back to present day with this Finnish landscape architect who does, who was a professional skateboarder that does skate parks. And after the podcast, I cold emailed him and said, and I gave him a, you know, a Skype architecture tour and, asked for a concept. So I, my oldest, I was a BMXer growing up, that kind of free thinking, but kind of baked in a community, kind of punk rock. So I can see my oldest son was getting into skateboarding, and we had kind of a piss poor that needed to be rethought. So
And you don't want them skating on all the important architecture in town. Right.
I encourage it. I don't think the city officials would, but no
dialogue. So
I got on the, in a small town, it's just, there's need everywhere. So like, all my friends are on a board or a committee or something. It's just like, if you have something to offer or give, like, don't hold it to yourself. There's a way to plug into a small community and get involved with the civic, you know, our civic spaces. So when this committee was starting, I got on the committee to redo the skate park. And I actually was on the committee with my oldest son. And it took 2 years to develop and build, but maybe one of the most rewarding things I've ever been part of.
Cool.
Awesome.
It was like because of the collaboration and like you can do it for your son, or like why was it such
You know, I think there's people who advocate for soccer teams and baseball teams and the, you know, kind of organized sports, but kind of with alternative sports, it's a different personality. It's a different mindset. You're not competing against everyone, you're competing against your yesterday self. Right. And that mindset has always resonated with me that I'm not competing with anyone. I'm not competing with anyone. I'm just trying to be a better version of myself. And I think skateboarding and alternative sports actually, like you can have the self, you can have this drive and actually form your own path and get better at something, which is, so that's always resonated with me. So to be able to advocate for a whole group of kids who maybe are on the fringe of, let's say, quote unquote, normal.
Yeah.
It was really cool to have to build something as a community that we could all be proud of. It was the skate park when it was finished was written up in the New York Times, you know, and was a significant work of architecture in Columbus, you know, outside of, you know, normal civic buildings. And then from there, I've consulted with and have worked with Yane again on a skate park in Oaxaca, Mexico.
Oh, that's amazing.
Oh, that's awesome.
Will be built in the next couple of years. But I feel like design can work in a public space. I feel like when it does work, it really works, you know?
Yeah.
And then I've done some other projects locally. I'm actually, after those kind of big projects, I'm actually taking a break from anything large and monumental in 2 years, as my boys are 15 and 17, and my energy has to be, it has to be at home again. It has to, you know, there's not a whole lot of years left of them in school, and, you know, they're going to be starting chapters in their lives soon. So I've actually kind of come back towards the family unit and the importance of being home as much as possible. So I've actually redesigned my business the last 3 years to be home all the time.
That's pretty lucky in light that there's a pandemic that's forcing a lot of people to be home right now.
Yeah. This hasn't been too much different than my normal life. I've been since the end of 2013, where I made a hard decision to, where the priority is home and the kids and the family, and then everything. It's like my business became a design problem. Like, how can I solve this? You know, I'm being pulled in too many directions. And, so like, unlike a lot of artists and designers, I don't produce the work myself. It's just a continuation of what I learned at Wright, is I find the best people to do the work
and I have the best welders and the best press break people and the press, you know, all these guys who are have been doing the same job for 10, 15 years and are, you know, fully seasoned in what they do. So I'm able to delegate a lot of those responsibilities, and the design of the company then really has to be about me pulling myself out of it as much as possible.
That's great. That's really cool. Are you able to do, I assume you're able to do more. I mean, not maybe not just with your business, but your life because of that. I mean, I think that's the, you're not.
Yeah.
That's really great.
During these last 3 years of realizing of kind of redesigning the business to be home all the time, you know, I'm 39 and just kind of going through those periods of life of self-discovery. And, you know, because I didn't have these, you know, the traditional college moments and early, you know, find yourself moments, it's kind of come later for me. And, you know, realizing that I'm a 90-95% introvert. So the small cities actually make a lot of sense for me. I love people. I just, introversion can kind of be misinterpreted as shyness. And it really it's about energy consumption and how much either people energize you or they pull energy from you. So being in a smaller city, there's less to do. So I do less, which means I have a lot of breathing room to recharge. So that when I do expend energy, it's super deliberate, and then I have to retreat and recharge. And then I've kind of figured it out now, like, you know, Design Miami this year, I felt like, oh my gosh, I fully got it down. I was taking 2 naps a day and popping in and out. And
yeah, right.
But I think personality, you know, we're not all the same. There's 16 personalities, 32 sub-personalities. And on top of that, so many variations of all of them. So realize who you are, what your strengths and weaknesses are, has been really beneficial for me to, even in preparation for this call, you know, I went from I was meditating probably a half hour before this call to kind of recharge. And that's been an important tool.
That's great. I mean, it seems like you've, over the course of your career and life, you've figured out how to adapt things to, or make a fit, you know, make them work to you. Your job at Bright, starting off, you know, now your process with your current, you know, ventures with yourself, and then even moving forward, your family and making sure you're making them priorities number one. And I think that's pretty admirable. I think a lot of people are kind of bend until they break, and, that's pretty cool, Jonathan. That's pretty unique.
And I think that those efficiencies then translate into business, because you only have so much to give. You have what you give count. So, you know, when I'm in nature, I don't think about work. I don't think about design. I don't think about connections or details or materials. Like, all the flood of information that visually I get in an urban environment, I don't get in nature. I could completely shut off.
Right.
So I've had a quest for 5 years to get some land so that I can go to and, you know, just escape.
Right.
And we finally fulfilled that dream last month. We purchased 5 acres in Brown County, which is a half hour west.
Oh, that's awesome. And
we've been going there every few days, and last night I was there from to midnight, started a fire and macheted some brush and like came back as a totally different person. Like it was I've awesome. Kind of realized what it takes to charge the batteries.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah.
Is there, you know, this has been like a great time talking about this stuff and exploring a little bit about you, things I didn't know, which was really great. Is there anything that we should bring attention to that might be coming up in the near future? I know, you know, you have a project, anything on the horizon that you'd like to discuss while you're on the podcast or?
Yeah, so I think some of the fun aspects of being a furniture designer is, especially early on, is you have hard constraints with furniture. You know, the table has to function, it can't wobble, it has to, you know, be of a certain height to be usable. So you have all these hard constraints. And that was super helpful in the beginning to, you know, like, okay, here's my input data and these are factors into an output. And as I've been doing this now since 2006, I learned a lot along the way. And now there's a little liberation that I've kind of gained courage for the last year. No, really 2 years, starting with the Neshi Dome. Even though the Neshi Dome is functional, I kind of saw it as a piece of sculpture. And now, kind of even going further, there's just a whole line of sculptural works that are non-functional that I'm exploring. So I'm super excited about these just because kind of removing some of the constraints have been liberating to explore scale and material and finish choices, and hopefully interact with the public realm. So I have a few opportunities in downtown Indianapolis that are in process.
Nice.
Some smaller scale furniture pieces that have kind of led to a potential opportunity in Miami. So I'm excited about scales, as I've talked about for years as exciting next step. And it's kind of nice to be in the beginning stages of that. Those kind of early stages of doubt and I don't know if I can do this, or, you know, you'd work all day and the work is shit. You know, like, I like that feeling of not knowing if I can do this, but then taking those, I just took a gamble on some self-initiated sculptures, and super proud of them now. They just got some back from the metal shop last week.
Cool.
So that's fun. It's been super fun. I think I'm daydreaming of a cabin on my property in the woods. So that'll be kind of a journey that happens. But really kind of just being really deliberate about being home as much as possible while the kids are this age and nurturing the relationships that are closest to me. And just really prioritizing what's important. I think this time in history has really kind of shown a lot of people that just, you know, what we all thought was important at some point, when you really kind of zoom out a little bit, it's not important at all. Right. So kind of designing a business and a career that's integrated with, you know, these tiers of importance, I think is really important.
Absolutely. It's definitely shifts a lot of priorities for a lot of people, both with and against their will. But well, that's good to hear. I'm glad you're doing well, and you happen to be working the way you want to be working already. And I really want to thank you for taking time out of, you know, spending energy with us.
That was great talking to you, Jonathan.
Yeah, I think it's
for sure. Thank you for the invitation, and looking forward to, you know, having a lunch with you after this is all over.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait to come back to Columbus too. I appreciate the tour you gave me last time, the in-person one, and you know, I'd love to do that again. It'd be real fun.
Well, thank you both.
Yeah. Take care, Jonathan.
Have a great day. Have a good one.
All right, bye guys.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Creative Direction. You can find this episode and all of our other episodes at creativedirectionpodcast.com or iTunes or anywhere else your favorite podcasts are distributed. This podcast is sponsored by Clever Editing. The difference between good content and great content is a little clever editing. Get a quote today at cleverediting.com.